Okay, we'll continue reviewing today. An awful lot of material to review, really. Chapter 11 today, dative case. We talked about genitive case yesterday. And this chapter was done the same way, basically, an inductive method where you inspected the examples that were given there and then made deductions about them, both in terms of form and meaning syntax. And we won't belabor all of that. I think this is pretty straightforward. Basically, your dative case is going to be denoting what function in a sentence, what's the basic function of the dative case in a structure. Indirect object, right, indirect object. And even in a more general sense, you might say that to or for which the action is performed, that which somehow is receiving benefit from the performance of the action, although it may not be directly receiving the action. And very often this is going to be translated by the indirect object structure in English. And then when it doesn't fit an indirect object structure in English, you usually see it translated by the preposition to or for, something of that nature. So that's basically what the syntax is all about here on these next pages. And the forms are already there in section 82. We've talked about the forms yesterday anyway, so we won't belabor that. The last section, 85 here, is about the only one I want to draw any attention to. The Greek dative in sentences with structure noun in the nominative verb, noun in the dative, noun in the accusative, can frequently be rendered as the indirect object in this English sentence with structure subject verb, indirect object, and object. It can also be rendered by phrases with to or for, whether or not it can be rendered by an indirect object, and sometimes in other ways. The most common of these are illustrated below. So here we see a few examples here. Ho theos to huio exousion edoken. God gave the Son authority, or God gave authority to the Son. So there's your indirect object situation. Ho theos tois judaeos nomos ethiken. God made the Jews laws, or God made laws for the Jews. Here is an instance in which it wouldn't really be an indirect object, but in English we would translate it for, and the same kind of function is seen there. And I guess in the first situation, you might, I don't know if you could call that an indirect object. I guess you could. In the second instance, in the rewording there with the prepositional phrase for, and we see we do it with prepositional phrases. This gives a slightly different flavor than just a simple, you know, to with reference to or something. Here we see, krites katekrinen thanato ton doulon. The judge condemned the slave to death. So he condemned him to death. And there again, it's almost, in this case, it's almost complementing the meaning of the verb. In other words, the verb, he condemned him, and then to death is an adverbial type of function here, and using the dative in reference to completing the idea of the verb. So there's a few more oblique uses here. In the next example, let's see, the wicked disciple betrayed the Lord to the soldiers. That's having to do more with the nature of the verb betray. Certain verbs will take dative type of modifiers. The next example here about the soldier pierced the side with a spear, longhe, is just a dative form, and they're translating it with a spear. And this would be an instrumental. We'll call this an instrumental use of the dative a little bit later on, where the dative is being used to express means, instrument. Yes, Jim?
Would you ever see a preposition like in there?
Yes, you would. In fact, more often than not, you'd see a preposition "and" or something in this particular case here, as far as with a spear is concerned. But sometimes you'll see it without a preposition. And without the preposition, of course, it's a little bit less precise. Sometimes they're maybe intentionally a little bit less precise. But a very common idiom is to use the preposition "and" in a situation like this. And we'll get to that too. In fact, in many of these places with dative, you're probably familiar already with the fact that a lot of prepositions govern the dative case. And if you want more precision, more precise rendering, they'll often do that, use a preposition "and" as well as the dative case to generate more precision in the idea. Okay, another adverbial type of modifier. We have Jesus was speaking the word with boldness, parousia. They're a dative case form here. And then again, the word "with" isn't there in the Greek, but in English we're putting something in there to try to convey this idea. Again, in the Greek it would be considered perhaps a dative of means, and we'll get into, breaking down those categories this year as the various types of categories of dative. Of course, I think I've alluded to in the past to the fact that that many of the grammars break up the case system into 8 cases rather than into 4. And so what they'll have is the nominative, but they'll also have the vocative. They'll have the genitive and the ablative. They'll have the dative, instrumental, and locative. And all three of those, dative, instrumental, locative, all have the same form. See, there's a big raging debate, you know, as to whether you go by function or by form. If you go by forms, you got 4 cases, basically, although vocative sometimes has a different form. If you go by function, then you could argue for maybe 8, although once you begin to look into this idea of the dative, you'll see some certain commonality to the locative and the instrumental and the dative idea. And it may serve us better to see a more common root idea and then recognize these as specific areas in which that idea is modified by contextual considerations or something, and then have a little bit more general view of it. But we'll get into try to refine details of that as we go. Okay, well, the rest of these examples are pretty much along the same lines. And you kind of get an idea of the range of the use of the dative. But in every case, it's somehow modifying the action as to two or that for which the action is performed, or the manner in which the action is performed, the means by which it's performed, number of possibilities there. Okay, then we move to chapter 12 and we begin to look at verb forms. First, chapter 12 just dealt with the present and the future indicative active. And the first thing I'll just recall to your attention is the initial statements here as far as the structure of the verbal system in Greek in comparison to English. We see there in section 86, along about the middle of the section there, there's a sentence. In English, these the categories of verbs now are those of person, number, and tense. So we're concerned about person, number, and tense in English as far as our verb forms are concerned, and as far as the conjugation of those verb forms are concerned. So in English we have, for the verb walk, we have I, you, we, they, or the soldiers walk. And then in the third person we have he, she, or it walks. We change the form, we change the form of the verb in accordance with the person and the number, and the tense, of course. And we have forms walk, and then the form walked with an ed on it, indicating it's a morpheme indicating past time. But the paradigm system for English verbs is considerably simpler than Greek. Although in some ways we have so many irregularities, it's hard to even construct a consistent paradigm. But that's one nice thing about Greek: there are fewer irregularities. Although, as you well know, there are some. But the patterns are far more precise, and so we see in section 87 here, this first statement, the inflectional system of Greek verbs is much more elaborate. Inflectional forms serve to indicate not only person, number, and tense, but also mood, voice, and aspect. So you've got 6 pieces of information, in effect, that's coming forth through that inflectional system. And that will include the suffixes, any kinds of prefixes, like the augment, for example. There will also sometimes be infixes, like that sigma, is used to in the future and in the aorist. So, and sometimes there'll be suppletion or some sort of a change in the stem if you didn't put a sigma on. So there'll be prefixes, suffixes, and infixes that will affect the information that is transmitted by that verb form. And we're getting information on person, number, and tense, but also on mood, voice, and aspect. And of course, mood and voice are things that we get into. A mood, of course, has to do with the essentially has to do with the degree of reality, you might say, that is being expressed by the verb form. We've so far only dealt with indicative mood, and I guess we didn't quite get to imperative yet, did we? So we'll be getting to things like the imperative, and also to things like the optative and the subjunctive. And there you're getting into realms of possibility and so forth. So indicative is just describing an action, a simple statement of an action. The imperative is a command, and it's trying one person's will being imposed on somebody else. And then we find the subjunctive, which is dealing more with the realm of probability, and then optative, more with the realm of possibility, you might say. A little bit more remote, but we'll get into those as we go. Voice, what categories do we find in voice? What would be the 3 major voices? Right, active, passive, and middle. And that is a judgment as to how the action is related to the subject. If the subject is the receiver of the action, it's a passive verb form. If the subject is the performer of the action, it's an active verb form. If the subject is both performing the action and in some way also receiving a benefit from the action, it'll be a middle voice form. That's probably the more difficult one for us to really get a feeling for, since we're not used to looking at a middle form in English. We do have active and passive forms in English verbs, but we're not really tuned in on what a middle form is. So we do have things that transmit middle meaning, but it's usually done in more of a roundabout way rather than in a simple verb form. So those are the and aspect, of course, has to do with things like whether the action is a progressive action, in other words, an action that's taking place over a period of time in a progression, or whether it's being viewed as simply an indefinite thing. Doesn't mean that the action itself was indefinite, but it just means that the action itself is being viewed from the perspective that you're not concerned about its progression or anything else. All you're concerned about is the fact that the action occurred. And that's where you use your aorist and so forth, your indefinite aspect. Okay, so those are the kinds of pieces of information that are being transmitted by Greek verbs, and therefore the inflectional system is very elaborate in comparison to English. We look at the verb forms here for Greek, for luo here, and we see the basic, this isn't really a paradigm here yet, but he's kind of getting you familiar with what is happening. Luo meaning I loose or I am loosing, luais meaning you, singular loose or you are loosing, luae meaning he, she, it looses, etc. Or any other subject might also fit, the prophet, the widow, the child, etc. Luae also can be used for the children are loosing, simply because the word children in the Greek is neuter. And there's a peculiarity such that a neuter plural noun can take a singular, third-person singular verb form. So that's something you have to kind of watch for. It's not demanded, but it's normally what's done. And there aren't very many neuter nouns dealing with people that do things anyway. Children is one of the most common ones that you'll find. Luo men is the first-person plural. We loose or we are loosing. Luete, second-person plural. You plural loose or are loosing. And luusi or luusin, that new there is movable. They loose or are loosing, the prophets, the widows, the children loose or are loosing. Mentions a couple of points about the Greek verb forms. First point here is about the fact that the English, each Greek expression corresponds to two English ones, either the indefinite action or the progressive action. So I loose would be indefinite, and I am loosing would be a clear statement of a progressive aspect. And so the present tense in Greek is not going to be able to, if you have a present tense form, you have to go by context to decide whether it's a progressive or indefinite aspect. Whereas when you get to the past tense, you'll have separate forms. The imperfect will be your progressive and the aorist will be your indefinite. The English pronouns I, you, he, she, it, etc. must in English they must be expressed, but in Greek they need not be because the endings of the verbs take care of that. And you can go ahead and add those pronouns to it, but that will give even stronger emphasis. It's almost redundant in Greek when you do that, and that gives strong emphasis. In both English and Greek, the verb agrees with the subject in person and number. So there's concord rules that are involved here, where the verb will have to agree with the subject in person and number. And, of course, he does mention this exception of the neuter plural subject may have a singular verb. So that's an exception to that rule. Okay. Section 86 is just basically talking about the indicative forms, which make a simple statement of fact. And the section 89 deals with the dictionary form of an English verb being the infinitive without the function word to. That's the way the English, because the English, that's usually the simplest form of a verb in English, so that's the form that's appropriate to put in the dictionary. But in Greek, the dictionary form is going to be your first person singular present indicative active form. That's generally the simplest form as far as its looks is concerned. You don't have, all you have is one simple suffix, and you don't have it loaded with prefixes and infixes and all the rest. So it's the easiest thing to work with as a basis. And this, again, is just largely a grammatical convenience. It isn't that there's anything intrinsically special about the first-person form. It's just that it happens to be the simplest form. Now, in Hebrew, they use the third-person masculine singular form as the dictionary form. rather than the first person, because in Hebrew that turns out to be the simplest form to work with. So it's just a matter of picking the form that's the easiest to work with and easiest to build the rest of the paradigms with, and that's the one that's used in the dictionary. So in Greek, it is the first person singular present indicative active form, in this case, luo. This is also called the first principal part of the verb. Can anybody give me a definition of what principal parts really are, of what... I guess it says it right here in the next one, so it's kind of unfair. But the principal parts of a verb are those forms which one must know in order to be able to construct all the other forms. That's all it really involved. Again, it's a grammatical convenience. It isn't that there's something intrinsic about a certain form that makes it a principal part. It's just that when we are constructing paradigms and trying to put things together, we try to find the forms, we try to reduce our memory load to the minimum. I mean, human beings are basically lazy, and so we're trying to find out what's the simplest and easiest way to learn all the forms. And so we try to reduce it to its simplest form, and if we can discover the fewest possible forms one needs to learn in order to construct all the other forms, that's what the principal parts are really all about. For a lot of verbs, all you need is the first principal part. If they're totally regular, and they totally follow, you know, regular rules, all you would really need is the first principal part, and you can construct all the rest. Luo happens to be one of those. If you know luo and you know the rules, you can construct the entire paradigm just from the first principal part. But unfortunately, in general, it's not always that way, because you have lots of other exceptions and so forth and irregularities. And because of that, there are a total of 6 principal parts. And you find that chart in the back of your book that lists the principal parts for some of the most common verbs, and we'll be having occasion to look at that list a little bit more closely this year. But the present active is the first principal part of the verb. Okay, then he mentions the concept of regular verbs and irregular verbs here over here on the next page, just before we get to section 90, the last part of section 89. And it says, verbs like love and kill, for which the first principal part is a sufficient basis for the construction of all the remaining principal parts and other forms, are sometimes called regular verbs. Other verbs are called irregular and may be divided into subclasses according to the manner in which the first and third principal parts are formed from the first. Or, excuse me, which the second and third principal parts are formed from the first. Okay, so that's true in English, and you'll see the same kind of thing true in Greek. Section 90 here is dealing with the concept of a base plus endings. This is the way to look at our verb forms. We look at the base, which is, you might say, a morpheme that's indicating the specific meaning of that verb, the kind of verbal action you're dealing with. And then the endings would be morphemes that would indicate, a smallest part of a word that has meaning. It would be a piece of the word that is indicating other meanings, tense, voice, etc., these other things that we talked about, person, the number, and so forth. So these endings are the endings that are added to the present base lu to form present tense, and we call these the primary active endings, just because these same endings will be seen on other verb forms, and so we want to try to come up with a general term for them. And of course, we see omega, epsilon iota, sigma, epsilon iota, omicron mu, epsilon nu, epsilon tau, epsilon, omicron mu, epsilon sigma, with the optional nu there. Okay. Paradigms, then, on the top of page 72, have the paradigm for luo, and then next to it, we have the paradigm for the future, luso. And if you examine the two, by inspection, you can see the only difference is that we have a sigma at the end of the base before the ending to form the future. So we have one more little morpheme there, you might say. And so this is, in general, the way that the future is formed, adding the sigma to the present base and then adding the primary active endings. And so he says here in section 92, the second paragraph, for a great many Greek verbs, it is possible to form the future base in this way by adding sigma to the present base. For others, however, this is not the case, so that the first person singular of the future tense is the second principal part of a Greek verb. So here we have a problem, potentially, because for a real simple regular verb, you can go ahead and just add a sigma on, and there's no problem. You can form the second principal part, as it were, from the first by predictable rules. But it's not always the case. Sometimes certain letters will not like to take a sigma on them. Certain ones will have certain phonological changes that we'll talk about here a little bit later. But those are pretty, once you know those phonological changes, those are pretty predictable. You can even call that a regular future. But many of them will not take the sigma at all, and instead there may be an accent shift, there may be a suppletion, a change in the stem, something of this nature, which will mean that, and that may be a highly unpredictable or a totally unpredictable change. And in those circumstances, one needs to know the second principal part. You need to know what that does in order to build the rest of the verb forms. And so the future is the second principal part of a Greek verb in general. And many of them are going to, the ones that are regular, of course, will be no problem. But for the ones that are irregular, you need to know that information. Okay, then section 93. Basically here, if the verb stem ends in a vowel or a diphthong, then you have no trouble adding a sigma on. So that's going to pose no problem for the future. So he just lists a bunch of verbs that are that way. And they're all quite regular. Now, though, if it ends in a consonant, you have more complications. The same kind of complications we later ran into with the third declension. In the third declension, we had the same kind of problem, adding sigmas onto things. And some things take sigmas just fine, other things don't. So looking at the top of page 73, we see some examples of what happens. Pempo, for example, in the future becomes pempso. Dioko becomes dioxo. And we go from the P to the psi, or from the kappa to the xi there. But still, this is quite logical if you just think of the fact of what the sound is. A psi is a PS sound. So if your stem ended in a P and you put a sigma on it, you'd get a PS sound. And since they have a letter that covers that sound, they just change it to that letter and you get a psi. So really, it's no problem. And the rest of this page just goes into talking about what will happen in the if the base ends in certain letters. And so basically you're concerned about the base, if the base ends in a P and a beta or a phi or a P tau plus a sigma, that'll result in a C. In fact, it's all summarized on the top of page, the next page, so you may just want to look at that rather than go through all this again. I think you're all, you know, familiar enough with it. That all we need to look at is this little chart at the top of page 74, section 94. And you need to memorize that chart for third declension anyway, so it's one that gets a lot of use. But if the stem ends in P, beta, phi, or P, tau, if you add a sigma to it, you get C. If it ends in a kappa, gamma, chi, or double sigma, which is maybe unusual, obviously you can't have three sigmas, so it becomes xi. And then delta, theta, or zeta plus the sigma will result in just a sigma. In other words, an effect that just kind of drops out. So those phonological changes then that we memorize will cover a good number of these future forms, and we could still consider them regular if we consider this phonological change. Okay, do we have any questions about the present or the future indicative active verb forms there? Just a matter of review and you know, memorizing those endings again, basically. No, if it... usually the ones that end in a single sigma are going to be irregular. They're going to get some kind of suppletion or change in the stem or something like that, or an accent shift or something like that. That's usually what happens to those. Yeah. And things that end in a nu, they'll often do the same thing. They don't like to put a sigma on a nu. So they'll get some kind of change like that. So in other words, you can kind of predict if it ends in a consonant other than one of these. If it ends in a vowel, it's probably going to be just regular, just like luo. If it ends in a consonant other than one of these, you can expect some funny things to happen. Because you just don't like to add sigmas to consonants other than these. So that's where you're going to find your irregularities. Okay. Chapter 13, the past tenses of the indicative active. We've talked about the present and the future having this kind of a double meaning, either an indefinite aspect or a progressive aspect, and context has to decide which. But when you get to the past tense, you have two completely different sets of forms, and they indicate differences in aspect. They're both past tense forms. Both the imperfect and the aorist are past tense forms. The difference between the two is in aspect. The imperfect has got a progressive aspect without question, and the aorist has an indefinite aspect. And in fact, the word aorist itself comes from the Greek word aoristos, meaning indefinite. So that's the very idea of the word aorist, is that it's indefinite. And by indefinite, it doesn't really mean that the action itself, when it was performed, was an indefinite action. In other words, it doesn't mean that whoever performed the action didn't know what he was doing. That's not what we're talking about. All we're talking about is our present view of the action. the way that the action is viewed in the context in which it's being described. And so you see, sometimes if you're interested in a present situation and you're interested in data that's relevant to that present situation, you may not be interested in how that data was produced. You may not be interested in how long the action took or whatever, or any circumstances about what was taking place when the action actually occurred. All you're concerned about is that the action did in fact occur. And you're mainly concerned with the result of that action, so the aorist is very appropriate to that. And as you're saying, this happened, you know, and you're not trying to get into the details of it or how it happened or anything else. It's just a description of an action that took place. And so you'll use this aorist because you may not even been there to observe the action to even know. So you just put, but you do know that it occurred, so you put the aorist in. If you are trying to emphasize a progressive aspect to that action, that the action did take place over a period of time in the past, and in some instances may even be going on at the present, continuing in the present, you will use the imperfect form. So the aorist is kind of a catch-all in a way. It's something that, to use if you don't know what else to use. When in doubt, use the aorist, you know, and nobody can pin you down. But if you know that the action was progressive and you want to emphasize that, then you use the imperfect. Now, looking at the bottom of page 75, you see these two, the comparison of the two paradigms for the imperfect and the aorist. Eluon, elus, eluen, eluomen, elueta, eluon. There's the paradigm for the imperfect, and we find translating eluon as I was loosing. You get this past progressive aspect. The aorist, on the other hand, elusa, elusas, elusen, etc., is translated I loosed, and you get this indefinite aspect. Now, as far as the forms are concerned, you can see one thing in common to both of those paradigms, and that is the augment, as it's called, the epsilon that's prefixed. Now we have a prefix. The stem is still lu, and now you have an augment, the thing that's prefixed to it. The augment is an indicator of past tense. It's a morpheme that's indicating past time. And it's only present in the indicative mood. When we get to other moods and so forth, we won't see that. So there are, though, however, some complications when you put a prefix of an epsilon onto something. It's fine if the word begins with a consonant, but if the word begins with another vowel, then you have a problem of adding one vowel to another vowel, and it results in certain contractions. So there's a chart here on page 76 that tells you what happens if you're going to try to add an augment to a certain certain vowel. If you have an alpha that begins the word like akuo, you add the epsilon to it, it becomes eta. So you get akuon. And of course, the rest of the chart gives you the details there. If it's an epsilon, you get eta. If it's an omicron, you get omega. It just kind of lengthens it. If it's an iota, you get an iota, but it's usually a long iota sound. And if it's an epsilon, you get a longer epsilon sound. Sometimes it's real hard to make any difference there. And it's sometimes, you know, like he mentions here, the lengthening of iota and epsilon is not represented in ordinary text, though sometimes it is in grammatical works. And pronunciation gets pretty loose on a lot of these things anyway, so you can't hardly go by that, and it's hard to make a difference there anyway. So you can kind of think of it as being virtually lengthened or something, you know. It's in effect, there's a lengthening taking place, but you don't see any real change in the form. Then with the diphthongs, if you start with an alpha iota and you add the augment to it, you get an eta with the iota subscript. And alpha upsilon, you get eta upsilon. Omicron iota becomes omega with the iota subscript. Epsilon upsilon becomes eta upsilon. And or sometimes it may be just left unchanged. And this gets a little tricky sometimes, because if you see a form like that, with the epsilon upsilon in the beginning, you may not know what the dictionary form was, because you may not know exactly whether the augment's on there or not, and just what the form was. So you do run into certain ambiguities there when you're dealing with the verb form. If you haven't seen the verb before, you may have some question as to what it is. So you'll never really completely overcome your need for the analytical lexicon. You'll find yourself consulting it on occasion when you see a strange verb you haven't seen before, and you're trying to find what the dictionary form was. There will be a few subtleties that still remain. Epsilon iota is always left unchanged, so that's another one where you have to be real careful. If you're looking at a particular form, especially when you get into imperatives and some of these other things where the endings get shorter and that type of thing, you can miss. form that you're looking at sometimes. Yeah, if the form is the same, you may, sometimes the form will be the same, and it'll help, it'll let you know that the forms don't change. Now you have to go by context to decide which it is, right? Exactly. Okay, then the forms of the imperfect are obtained by adding the augment to the present base, and then adding the following endings. And here we see a different set of endings than the set of endings we put on the present. We have omicron nu, epsilon sigma, epsilon with optional nu, then omen eta, and then omicron nu again. Then the forms of the aorist are obtained by augmenting the present base, adding sigma just like you did with the future, and then adding a different set of endings. These are endings that have a thematic alpha. There's an alpha in most of the endings except the third person singular. So we have alpha, alpha sigma, epsilon with optional nu, amen, ate, and an. So we have a different set of endings there. It's pretty clear there. Now, if it was left at that, we'd probably have a lot simpler go of it. But unfortunately, we have some things called first aorist and second aorist that get into the situation. The imperfect is perhaps one of the most regular of all forms of the verb. There are a few exceptions, and echo is one of those. He mentions it here in section 4. And so it's pretty regular. And so you don't need to have another principal part to deal with the imperfect. It's best just to deal with just very few exceptions as exceptions and go ahead and make a rule about the formation of the imperfect. But the aorist is a different ballgame. And with the aorist, we do have enough irregularities such that the aorist is the third principal part of the verb, the aorist form. And once you know the aorist form of the verb, you'll know whether it's first or second aorist, and you'll know whether it's a regular, you know, in the category first aorist, there are regular ones and irregular ones. And the first aorist is largely determined by the ending system that it has, but I guess we'll hold that just for a minute. We're going to get to that in just a moment. Point number 5 here is just like with the future, when you add a sigma to the present base for the aorist, the same phonological changes occur as occur for the future. And so if the stem ends in a P, beta, phi, or P, tau, the result is going to be a C. If it ends in a kappa, gamma, phi, or double sigma, it's going to be a C. If it ends in a delta, sigma, or zeta, it's going to be a sigma. So it's the same exact situation that you found there with the future. But section 6 here is where our problems come. Verbs which have aorist forms with the endings given in section 3 above are said to have first aorist. So the thing that determines a first aorist is the endings that it has. If it's got the alpha-type endings, it's a first aorist. Whether or not there's been a change in the word, in the base or something like that, it's the endings that are going to determine first aorist. Most verbs have first aorist, and the majority of these verbs form their first aorist regularly as set forth in section 3 above. Some verbs, however, form their first aorist irregularly or by suppletion. It is advisable to commit the most important of these to memory among the most common of the following. So here we see an example. There's 5 of them that are mentioned here. The first 2 are me verbs, and they're in a different conjugation, so you might expect those to be strange. But looking at the last 3 here, Pharaoh, for example, the first aorist is anenka, and how you get that from Pharaoh is a real good question. It's not only suppletion, but it seems to be just a total change. And some feel that it's even come from a completely different verb where they had 2 different verbs and they kind of mixed them together in one paradigm, dropped out forms of one and the other and so forth and mixed them together. It's a possibility. Krino becomes ekrina, and it's an irregular first aorist because you didn't add a sigma to the stem. And actually nothing really much has changed in the stem. You just didn't add anything onto it. But you do have the alpha on there, and that's going to indicate it's first aorist. This is not a second aorist, because second aorist has a different ending system. And then meno, the same thing, mena, there you did see a change there. You have a change from an epsilon to an epsilon iota in the stem. But again, this nu doesn't like to take a sigma, so something's going to happen. Or something is going to try to happen anyway. So these are irregular first aorists. Now we come to the question of a second aorist. What's a second aorist? A number of important verbs have second aorists. That is, their aorists are formed irregularly or by suppletion, and they have, instead of the endings given in section 3 above, the endings of the imperfect given in section 2 above. Verbs of this type must be memorized. Some of the most important ones are listed. See, there isn't any way for you to really know or predict whether something's going to have a first or second aorist. You can pretty well tell if it's going to be irregular somehow. You know, if you can't add the sigma to it, there's something strange about it, you can guess that it's going to be either a irregular first aorist or a second aorist, but you won't know for sure which without just memorizing the verb. And so he's trying to give you some of the most common ones that do that, and here's a list of about five verbs that are very common second aorists. And the second aorist, basically what happens is you've got a change in the stem somehow. Something happens to the stem, and you get endings that are the same as the imperfect. Now, if you didn't have a change in the stem, then there wouldn't be any difference between the imperfect and the aorist form. So there has to be some change in the stem somehow in order to discern between the difference between an aorist and the imperfect. So lapo, for example, in the future is lapso. No problem there, you can just add a sigma to it, but it turns out to have a second aorist. And you might even not have predicted this. I mean, you might have predicted this to be regular, or at least to have that simple phonological change, but it turns out to be elipone, and you get a stem change from an epsilon iota to just an iota. Now, its imperfect form would be given further down here. You see the next paradigm down gives the imperfect and the aorist the full comparison between the two. And the only difference between them, the ending systems are the same, the augments the same. The only difference is the stem, L-apone versus L-apone. So it's only a stem change that makes the difference between imperfect and second aorist forms. Endings and so forth are just the same. And there's five verbs, lapo, ago, hirisco, echo, hamartano, are some of the most common of the second aorist forms. Okay, meanings of the aorist and the imperfect, they kind of overlap a little bit. Again, you get into this question of translation, which usually is dictated by a number of other factors than simply the verb form, so they're kind of stuck with giving you a bit of a range here. You have to look at the context in each case to decide for sure. But there is a little bit of overlap in some situations. Basically, though, in your exercise work and in just as a rule of thumb, if you see an imperfect form, you'll want to translate it in such a way that the progressive aspect is obvious. That's the thing that the main criterion that I would try to stress. If you see an imperfect form and you're going to translate it into English, try to bring a progressive aspect out of it. Either I used to loose or I was loosing. So a translation like that where you're getting that clear progressive aspect. It may be, you see, he's got also I loosed and I did loose all under that category of the possible translations of the imperfect. But I loosed and I did loose, they can be progressive if the rest of the context is showing that. I mean, if the rest of the context of the sentence is such that you're pretty clearly dealing with progressive actions, and then you say, I loose, or I did loose, or something, I loosed, you may be able to pick it up. But to prevent any doubt about the matter, I think you're still safer just by translating it with I was loosing, or I used to loose, somehow giving a progressive aspect to it. Then in the aorist, you see that the last three translations are I loosed, I did loose, or I have loosed, are all possible translations of the aorist, but you wouldn't want to translate the aorist as I was loosing or I used to loose, because if you wanted to say that, you'd use the imperfect. So for the aorist, just to translate any one of those three would be fine, kind of depending on the context, but don't translate the aorist by a progressive aspect, because if you do so, you're committing, you're making a commitment, as it were. Now, let me say it this, put it this way. The fact that an aorist verb is used does not preclude the action having been progressive. The action when it was performed may in fact have been progressive. In fact, you may find two scriptures talking about the same action. One of them uses an aorist and one of them uses an imperfect. From that situation, you could tell that the action was progressive, but one of the verses was only viewing the result of the action. He wasn't viewing the progress of the action, so an aorist was used. And so it's best, if you've got an aorist form, to translate it in one of these indefinite ways. Don't commit yourself to don't use an imperfect translation when you've got an aorist form. Even though the action may have been progressive, that's not in view in the particular verse in question. Okay. Yes, Tony?
First and second aorist both translate the same.
Yes. First and second aorist, there's no difference in meaning. The distinction between first and second aorist is only one of forms. It's only a formal distinction, but meaning is not affected. Okay. Anyone else? Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering, Greg? With Credo up there, what would be the future that probably would be?
Yeah, they don't have it here, but it's Crino, and they just have an accent change, and there's no sigma on it. So that's one of those that's really irregular. And it's just an accent change that is what they'll do. Sometimes there won't even be an accent change. It'll just look the same. You have to go by context.
So that's how you're
going to
determine between presence.
Right.
And that accent.
Exactly, because the ending system's the same. And if you don't have an accent change, you can't tell the difference. So either that or context, you know. Sometimes, of course, if we're not paying a strong attention, those are the places where we have to pay attention to accents because they make a difference in meaning. Yeah, go ahead, Greg.
I had a note here that I've gotten out of a different grammar, and it said that the mu and the nu and the lambda and the rho, none of those took the sigma.
Right. Now, those are called liquid. Right, that's real consistent. In fact, the same problems occur with those. Those are called the liquid stems in the third declensions, because those are the same guys that give you trouble in third declension, and they're all in the same category. But you can see back here on this chart in the back of the book, let's see, we're talking about Crino. If you look at page 331, in the middle of the page you have Crino there, meaning judge. And then if you look at the next, the future active there, it's Crino. Notice you've got a circumflex on the last syllable now. And that's the only difference between those two. And things that end in nu like that especially are going to be that. If you look at meno a little bit further down, that's about another half way again down. Meno, you've got meno for the future, just an accent change. And then the aorist, emena, you did get a suppletion there, so that's a little bit easier to tell there for the aorist, but the future is just almost the same. So it gets kind of difficult in some of those forms. There aren't very many like that, but there's enough to warrant some problem. Balo over there is a little bit interesting, too. If you go back on page 330, about halfway down, we have balo there with two lambdas, and there's one you can't add a sigma to a lambda, you see. So it's going, something else is going to happen. Well, this gets an accent shift and only one lambda for the future, balo. So those are the kinds of things that will happen with those futures. And egero, down there a little bit further down, egero, you have a stem ending in ro. That's one of those that is liquid. And the future is egero, an accent shift. And also its suppletion there, the iota drops out and you just have epsilon. So those are the kinds of things that will happen. And you can kind of guess where those... And when you see one of those that ends in a stem like that, with a rho or a lambda or something of that nature, you can say, well, I'm dealing with something that's going to be a problem. I don't know exactly what it's going to do, but you have some guesses, you know. Generally, you're going to see an accent shift. And then in addition to that, you may see a slight suppletion in the form, too. So you kind of get used to those. You kind of know what to look for. If you run into a form like that, you can make some pretty good guesses even as to how to look up what the stem would be after a while, but you can't always be certain. Okay, anyone else? Question on those forms for the past tense?
Yeah, Mike, would that certain pressure then fall all the way through on like the data and the iota, or the epsilon, the iota, all the way down?
Yeah, as long as you don't get in trouble with the rules. In other words, in accordance with the accent rules, it's going to try to fall in the last syllable. But if you get a short syllable in the last syllable and so forth, you can't have a circumflex on it and so forth. So you'd have to kind of go through the paradigm and see what happens to it. But the principle is that's in that first form, you try to keep it on the last syllable if it's possible according to the rules. And sometimes the accent will still be in the last syllable, but it can't be a circumflex. It has to be an acute or something because it's short syllable or something. If it violates one of those rules. Since we don't really, you know, strain our brains to try to, you know, figure out the accents in each case, because in most cases it doesn't have that, huge effect on meaning, but that's the principle that you'd follow. And there are some special accent rules back there, if you want to take a look at them, for verbs, and there are some things that happen with certain verb forms and noun forms that are exceptions to the rules, so you need to look at those too. But that's basically what you want, because you want to see some difference all throughout the paradigm, if possible. Because if you get a certain form where there's no difference at all, then you're stuck with context, and they try to avoid that if you can. And remember, too, that the original unsealed manuscripts had no accents marked. So, I mean, the text that we have, if there is a form that there's no difference between the future and the present, for example, what you see in UBS text has been a decision that they've made. where they, when they, when they put the accent on the form, they made a decision based on the context and so forth that they felt that this is a future form or that this is a present form. And that's something that's wise to, it's good to know that in case you may have some cause to doubt the conclusion that they came to. If you know what the valid possibilities, excuse me, are, then you can perhaps make some question even about, sometimes the decision they made is based on their theology. So that's something to be aware of. When it comes to forms that are differing only by the accent, it's well worth looking into the possibilities of the other form being used.
Mm-hmm. So then if it wasn't the Greeks who put the accents on at all?
Well, the Greeks did, but...
Off of the grammar or something
else. No, the Greeks did use the accents, but the unsealed manuscripts were all capitals. They didn't put accents in. They didn't have punctuation or anything. Later on, when the minuscule manuscripts, you know, the minuscule style was developed and so forth, apparently they used these accent forms, and they use them even today. You know, I was talking to Themis and so forth, and they, when they write in Greek and so forth, they still use the accent to some extent, although he said they just very recently streamlined that even, to where they're using less and less. But they did use them with the minuscule manuscripts and so forth, where they had a lowercase and so forth. But if you have all caps, it's real hard to put accents in anyway, and if you've ever seen those unsealed manuscripts, you don't see any marks at all except capital Greek letters and no spaces between the words and no punctuation or anything. It's just all run together. So it's a little bit difficult sometimes to make decisions as to how to put that together. And that's something to consider when you're doing exegesis, to consider the state of the text as it was and consider that decisions that are made, you know, are somewhat open to question. That's why you'll find in some places punctuation different from text to text and variations on it, and UBS, some of the editions of the UBS will give you variations in the various text editors as to how they had punctuated it, and that's kind of good to be aware of too. Consider some possibilities. None of them are going to make gigantic differences in meaning, but it may be enough to add some support or at least remove some support from an argument that a person was dogmatic about when you find that he doesn't really have any justification for claiming that dogmatically. Okay, chapter 14 then, we have these interesting, I don't know how we call these, semi-adjectives, or I think it's a term that he used, autos, hutos, and ekenos. And we have some peculiarities both syntactically and paradigmatically with these words as well to take note of. First, the word autos. If you look at the paradigm that's constructed there for autos, it's pretty much the same as, say, kalos would be. What would be the differences? What differences in the paradigm can you see from just looking at that? Or are there any differences between that and the paradigm for kalos, for example? Yes, Glenn? Right. The neuter, singular, nominative, and accusative forms are auto rather than what would you expect? Auton, yeah. You would expect a new on the end like if it was after the manner of kalos. But it has only auto. And have you seen anything else that has that reminds you of? A paradigm that's a very common paradigm that reminds you of?
Definite.
Yeah, the article. The definite article. Because you have to in both of those places. See, to technon. With the article, you don't have a new. With the ending on the adjective, you do. So this is like that. And that's the way I like to remember it, because that way it's... if you got something to associate it with that you're using all the time, it's a little bit easier to remember that. So there's only two places in that paradigm where you have peculiarities, and that's where you have auto instead of auton in the nominative singular and the accusative singular neuter forms. Okay, now, in addition to that slight paradigmatic irregularity, there's also a syntactical irregularity with this particular adjective. And that has to do, again, with these four possible positions. We have attributive positions, and we have predicate positions. With a normal adjective like kalos, the attributive position is translated something like, you know, the good God or something like that. And then the predicate position would be God is good. But with autos, we see a different... an attributive function in both the predicate and the attributive positions, but a different meaning for the word. The word is actually changing its meaning in the predicate position, and that's a peculiar thing. So, looking at these first two examples, the first attributive position, ho autos kurios, means the same Lord. So the word autos is meaning the same. The second attributive position, ho kurios ho autos, is also meaning the same Lord. So whether it's first or second attributive position, the meaning is the same Lord. But then you look down at the predicate position. Autos ho kurios doesn't mean the same Lord, but the Lord himself. the Lord himself. Now, there's a certain relationship in the meaning, of course. I mean, they're not totally and drastically different. But this last one has more of a demonstrative sense, kind of an emphatic sense, the Lord himself. And vocurios autos, same thing, that's the second predicate position, and that means the Lord himself. So we want to make a distinction here between the predicate and the attributive positions for this word autos in the meaning of it. Now, as you know, autos is not used only in this way. Autos is also used as a third person form of the relative pronoun. We're going to get to that later on. But not relative pronoun, but the pronoun itself. It's a plain pronoun. And we'll get to that a little bit later. But in its use as an adjective, which is what we're considering here, in those four positions, it's got a different meaning depending on the position that it's in. Okay, so the rest of this section 99 just kind of goes on to elaborate on that point and give some more examples. Section 100, autos, like an ordinary adjective, may be used as a noun. In such cases, it's preceded by the definite article. So it can function in a substantive position, and when it does, it means the same. So, hoi hamartoloi to auto poiusin, the sinners do the same. To auto, the same thing, or the same. And of course, being in the neuter here, you know, it's the idea of the same thing. Autos sometimes, section 101, autos sometimes occurs with proper names without an article. In such cases, it usually precedes and has the meaning himself or herself. Again, this is not too unusual, because if you consider a proper name as being definite, in effect, it's got the article. And so, in effect, autos out in front of Dawid, for example, is just like autos in front of Hokurios, which would mean the Lord himself, and this would mean David himself. Okay, then we have the Greek demonstratives, houtos and akenos. Houtos meaning this or these in the plural, and akenos meaning that or those. Now, demonstratives are just like what the grammatical term associated with them is. Demonstrate, something's demonstrative. Demonstrative means, in effect, you're pointing it out. You're demonstrating it. You're drawing attention to it. You're pointing it out. So this, you know, you're kind of, it's like a finger pointing to something real close to you, and that is something you're pointing to something further away. The difference between houtos and akenos is essentially one of proximity. If something's close, it's this, and if it's something far away, it's that. And whether it be in space or in concept or time or whatever, there's various realms in which that distinction can be made. But it's basically a proximity distinction when you're saying this versus that. Now, the paradigms for houtos and akenos are interesting. For houtos, we see the same problem with the that we saw with autos. In the neuter and neuter accusative and nominative singular forms, we have tuto rather than two-tone, like you might expect. In addition to that, though, we find this situation with a tau. So you started out with houtos, with a rough breathing, and then for the majority of the forms, you get a tau on the front. And it's only in the masculine and feminine singular nominative forms, houtos and houte, and in the masculine and feminine plural nominative forms, houtoi and houtai, that you don't have a tau. All the rest of the places, you got a tau on it. And in addition to that, in some cases, you've got like tutu, and the other one is tautes, taute. In other words, you've got tau alpha upsilon versus tau omicron upsilon. That distinction going on, too. So that makes it a little bit complicated as far as remembering this paradigm. However, the key again is if you remember your paradigm for the definite article, the same kind of thing happens here. The taus occur in precisely the same places they do in the definite article paradigm, and the rough readings occur in precisely the same places. And this issue of whether it's tau alpha upsilon versus tau omicron upsilon can simply be resolved by looking at the ending. If the ending's got an eta or alpha type ending, then it's going to get alpha upsilon, and otherwise it's going to get omicron upsilon. So there's some little things that you can look at that will help you and enable you to memorize that paradigm, and it's the same kind of thing that we see with the article in large part. So that's probably the harder one as far as the paradigms are concerned. Akenos is no problem. It's just exactly like autos, and it does have akeno there in the neuter nominative and singular accusative form instead of akenon. Other than that, though, it's just a regular paradigm for any other adjective. Okay, we're out of time here for today. We'll talk a little bit more about the syntax of these words, and then be marching on to personal pronouns and go fairly quickly through that, and then we'll start getting into the passive voice and complete our verb paradigms. then third declension, and then pretty soon we'll be up to where we are. Rob, do you want to? You just missed it by a few minutes there.
The data would be with reference to, or would it be in the realm of, or?
Well, I think with reference to is what they usually give, just because that's a little bit more general. Because in the realm of can even, you know, be a kind of a subcase of that idea of reference. They usually just use the term reference, you know, as the basic categorization for it. That's kind of what Dane and Matthew and the others do. But then under that, there's lots of subcategories. Your reference may be a realm, you know, it may be a, you know, the locative idea in which you're referring this thing to a larger category or something. That's the basic term that they've chosen. It's kind of a matter of judgment on the part of the grammarians, but that's what people most commonly use. Okay.
Morning, brother.